especially on this occasion. And I have a lot to be thankful for to the university and also to David. And being his first student and to hear that your advisor is retiring, it somewhat gives you a feeling of age and nostalgia. And as I did try to think back to what it was like back then and working under Dave and being his first student, and I sort of remember the fun parts a lot. I mean, I was probably not only his first student but the first U of T student to take a sabbatical during my PhD. So that was a wonderful opportunity where Dave went to Imperial College, and I was able to go with him, and I met Agnes Hertzberg, David Cox, just a wonderful opportunity. Again, it was just something that was David, you know, just say, I'm going to England, would you like to come? And it was just that easy. But there was a lot of hard work, and I think as his first student, I didn't realize how much hard work would be involved. I did bring one photo with me to try to capture that hard work. This is, well, you can imagine who that is by the pipe hanging from his lips, but it's a somewhat younger Dave Andrews than we are seeing today. I think if I can zoom out a bit, we can get a little more appreciation for what this is. It looks like a workforce, and he worked his students hard. I mean, I could remember working day and night, weekends, weekdays, including summers. You can't make out a face, but that's his first graduate student over on the the roof there. And this was quite an extensive work session one summer, I think 1978. And I guess I could zoom out one more picture. And you see, it was not only a one-on-one session. David liked to work with his students sometimes as a group. In the corner there is Solomon Minkin Kleiman, who's sitting here. So he was also a hard-working student. He may have been David's second student. You might notice that I think both Solomon and I have lost or become less hairy in time, and David's become more hairy. We've all gotten a little grayer. I think that's all for that picture. My talk today is on a subject that doesn't bear really on David's career, other than I guess three things related to David that sort of influenced this work. One is that, as you'll see throughout the talk, it's really based on data. So you'll be seeing lots of data in this talk, and I think that was one of the things I learned early on. You know, don't make assumptions, follow the data. The second thing is David's computational thrust. We think of him as a statistician, but he has a strong computational side. So I think this talk will relate a little more to the computational side of David. And the third part of it is more sort of inspirational. I sort of, under David, got a, he helped nourish a attitude of fearlessness. And you know, don't be afraid of any problem, and just go in and do it. So this is a talk about just doing it. And what I'm going to be telling you is, or describing, is a large data analysis effort. It's done by many people, not just myself. And again, I've given this talk once before to a data mining audience, where I sprinkled a little statistics in. And that statistic, there isn't a lot of statistics in the talk, so I'm actually anxious to give it here to get some feedback on where we might sprinkle more into it. But I think you'll see throughout the talk how statistics has influenced a lot of the decisions we made in trying to set up what we're trying to measure and why. So let me see if this works. So the outline is an introduction. Again, I'll show you lots of data, and that'll be the section on characterizing large networks. Some of the statistical thinking will come in the next two sections, defining what we mean by a dynamic graph and approximating it, and then also some statistics on the enhancing the subgraph, And then I think the things we're most proud of are using these beasts in real applications and describing some of the future work. I guess I'd like to take or remind you of what Jamie said at any time. If you really want to pester me, feel free to do so. Okay, so what do we mean by network data and so on? There's sort of two views of network. One is sort of a physical network, and the other is more of a social network. And we're going to be talking about the latter. But the former would be in telecommunications, you have switches that define the nodes in your network, and you have copper wires that describe edges in your physical network. In sort of data networks, these switches are replaced by routers, and instead of copper, you probably have fiber between them. But you can even think of the web, the World Wide Web, where nodes in a large network are the web pages, and the edges in this network, or the links, are the hyperlinks. And that's perfectly legitimate to think of networks in that way. We think more of networks, or in the sense of traffic flowing over or through the network. So we actually think of things on the edge of the network, the entities that are going to be transacting business over some physical network. And they may be doing it for communications, finance, commerce, whatever. And these data are kept on sort of the traversals of these entities throughout the network, whether they be voice data, retail transactions, or communications, or investment decisions. Now, the data we get are actually pretty simple and actually pretty clean. You don't really get data of the transaction, what's actually said, like, for instance, being said during a conversation or a telephone call. You get sort of data that describes when that transaction took place and maybe some salient characteristic of its size. So for the most part, our network data consists of a date and a time, a location, that is transaction IDs, say their phone numbers, IP addresses, your account numbers at a bank, and some idea of size, whether it be the number of bytes transmitted, the length of a phone call, the amount of a financial transaction or retail purchase. So there's data that these networks spit off of this sort. And the reason these data actually came into being was for a particular purpose, an important business purpose, primarily for billing. If it wasn't for billing, we probably wouldn't have access to such data, because as you'll see in a minute, there's a lot of it. And in many contexts, data is not free. There are costs associated with collecting data, moving data, and storing data, and analyzing data. So there has to be a good motivating reason to have data to begin with. And billing is a pretty motivating reason, because bills translate to money. So this data was not necessarily set up to do the types of things I'm going to be doing. It was meant to support a billing functionality. But by intercepting the data, you can start doing some interesting new things with it. And as I said earlier, we're going to focus on the transactors on this network. Now, sort of relating that to mathematics and statistics, clearly you think of networks, and the immediate thing you think of is graphs. They're certainly a convenient way to represent network data. And in the examples I'll be describing, we have a call graph. So it's a massive graph where phone numbers are nodes in this graph, and the edges in the graph are the communication between the different phone numbers. And so you can ask questions like, think of this big, massive graph. Are there interesting nodes in the graph? How close are two nodes to each other? Are two nodes behaving like each other? Is this node behaving at time t as it did a month ago? And how do we characterize and classify maybe subgraphs or atomic graphs, subgraphs of this big graph? So the focus of the talk is going to be on this type of data and these sorts of questions. So to get you started, I'm going to just show you pictures of some data to help characterize the size of the graph and some features of the graph. And so this, we're going to do a low volume service. I won't tell you what it is. We're going to look at it for a 22-week period, and we're just going to look at characteristic statistics of the number of edges and nodes, relationships, and some of the dynamics. What I'm going to be emphasizing throughout is this graph isn't a static object. Related to what David talked about earlier, we actually have a time series of graphs. So I don't know in books of time series that they talk about time series of graphs. You know, you sometimes do bivariate or multivariate time series analysis, but not a, you know, analysis of something as complicated as a graph. Okay, so here's the first of probably a half a dozen pictures to describe this low-volume service over a 22-week period. In this picture, this is a plot of, on the y-axis, the number of edges in millions, and on the x-axis, the number of nodes in millions. And every point is data for a single day. So on this day here, there were about 600,000 transactors, nodes active in the network, and they were involved in slightly over a million transactions, a million phone calls that day. So it's about the factor of two. And I've used two different plotting symbols. Open circles are what's happening on weekdays, and these plus signs are what's happening on the weekends. And that's just a feature of telecommunications data. One of the most salient features is there's a difference between business behavior and non-business behavior. So businesses dominate traffic on the network, certainly during the week, where residential consumer behavior dominates it on the weekend. And the volumes are reflected in that. I fit lines to the data separately, and you can see a slope of about slightly over two calls or two edges per node for weekdays, and slightly under two edges per node on weekends. And there are some outliers up here and down here. Those correspond to holidays or special events in the network that are easily explainable. A little bit on the dynamics. If you looked at the number of unique edges in this network and said, how many days do I see these edges? You can do a plot of the frequency with which you see these edges and the number of days on which they were observed. So what this says is that there were slightly over a million of these edges that were observed on exactly one day. Now maybe 500,000 of these edges were observed on exactly 2 days, and so on. Down here you see that there's a handful of edges that appeared on every day. But this is pretty typical of network data and a lot of things, you know, whether it be text or whatever. You know, it's a sort of indication of a power law, what's the so-called Zipf's law. Many of the transactors make very limited use of the network, where very few of the transactors make a lot of use of the network. To redisplay that data in a slightly different form, I've just accumulated these counts. And I put on a particular quantile. And this says that 95% of the edges occur on six or fewer days. So we looked over a 22-week period. I think that's 150-odd days. And 95% of the edges in this network were active on only six of those days, at most six of those days. Another way to think about the dynamics is to say, how long are these edges alive? What is the lifetime of edges? So you can compute for every edge the first time you saw it and the last time you saw it, and look at the number of days between the first and the last time. And this is a picture of that, the number of days between the first and last sighting for every edge over this 154-day period. And you see, for instance, that maybe that 77% were active. The lifetime of the edges were less than a week. 80% it was less than 2 weeks. About 85% less than a month. And about 90% of the edges were active for no more than 2 months over this 22-week period. I think this is one of my favorite pictures, so I might dwell on it a little longer than necessary. This is, in a dynamic graph, you have things coming and going. You don't have things just coming. If you read a lot of work on graph theory and mathematics, there are a lot of papers on generating random graphs. And there are generative models that show you add a node and then probabilistically you add edges to get different sorts of behavior. In real dynamic graphs, you not only have a generative process where nodes come in, but you also have this degenerative process where nodes and edges leave. And this picture is trying to capture this for nodes and the next one for edges. So what I'm doing here is the following. So let's start off at zero. This is the first day of the study period. I look at all the unique nodes in my network, and that's some baseline. And then every day I add to it the number of nodes that I see that day that I haven't seen before. And so what's growing up here is the cumulative number of nodes, unique nodes, I've seen since day one of my study. And you see that after a certain while, things become linear. That is, you know, I've basically just intercepted this data, so everything looks new on the first day, and, you know, regular customers that are usual customers, you start seeing them. But after a while, you know, you kind of get to a point where things are in steady state. And I think this steady state, I fitted a line to this steady state, and I think this corresponds to something like 16,000 new nodes every day. Now, what I did on this bottom plot is the opposite. Over the entire study period of 154 days, I had the list of nodes, and I said, okay, now how many after one day will I never see again in the study period? How many after 2 days will I never see, did I not see again after in the study period? And so you see this, we're in steady state in the beginning for this reverse process because I have the whole list of nodes. And then you get out of steady state after a while, and I fitted a line to this first part. And this line corresponds to the fact that I'm losing roughly 27,000 nodes a day. So this is obviously a dying service. I mean, less people are using it. Less newbies are coming in than oldies are going out. And this is a similar picture for the edges. I look at edges, the number of edges, unique edges I have on day one, and I start accumulating how many new edges I see on each successive day that I hadn't seen before. After a while, I get to steady state. I do the same with edges leaving, and I don't understand the linearity of the attrition of these edges. In terms of actual slopes on these lines, this corresponds to losing 400,000 edges a day, and we're gaining at a rate of 300,000 edges a day. So if each edge is a phone call, and again, this is a dying business because we're losing edges faster than we're gaining edges. And this might be the final plot I show, and this one is probably the most important one for what I'm going to describe next. Let's look at the degree, the connectivity of this graph over this study period. And in fact, I think I'm having a California moment like David did, but this one's from New Jersey. I think the study period for this, I truncated, so it's only over 28 days, roughly a month. And what this shows is, for every node over the study period, I looked at how many edges does it have coming into it and how many edges it has going out of it. And then I accumulated that. So there are, you know, let's just say 40% of the nodes have an in degree, which is the solid line, of about 2. About 60% of the nodes have an in degree at most about 4. I think this is the 90th quantile. 90% of the nodes have less than 8 or less edges coming into it, 13 or less edges going out of it. So that's giving you an idea of the connectivity of this graph. So again, there are tens of millions of nodes, hundreds of millions of edges, and in terms of connectivity, you know, again, things are connected, but there's just not a lot of density in the connections. If 90% of the nodes have their connectivity in degree less than 8 and out degree less than 13. Okay, so that's the prelude to just describe the data. And now we'll say, well, what? How do you get your arms around this? And I think that this is really the fun part, and this is, I think, where the statistical thinking influences the computer science. So we have to think of what we really mean by a graph, a dynamic graph, and how are we going to capture that and measure it and basically do data analysis with it. So a little bit of notation. Let's let this symbol here be an addition operator such that if all these G's are graphs, you can construct a new graph from two other graphs by essentially taking a linear combination of them. And that linear combination is the coefficients of that combination only come into play when you're sort of looking at the weights on the edges. When we think of these nodes and edges in a graph, we often put weights along the edges to convey the strength of those edges. So we want to differentially treat an edge where it may only correspond to a one-minute phone call to an edge that corresponds to, you know, four-hour phone calls every day. So you can think of having edges on these, or weights on these edges. So we're going to take the union of all the nodes and edges and these two, plop them into this thing, and the weights that we're going to propagate through to G3 is just going to be the convex combination of weights here. Now, if there's an edge that wasn't in here, we're just going to say that the edge weight was zero, and so the weight in the new part would just be alpha times the weight of the edge for the for G1. Okay, so that being said, that's just some notation that we'll use on this slide. How might we define a network graph? So one thing to do is take today's data. Just say, I'm going to do all my analysis on the data I have today, so my network graph is this. I think most statisticians, you know, don't like a sample of size 1. I mean, if we want to do something interesting, we tend to have n being bigger than 1. So this is probably too narrow of a definition to be useful for any real statistical analysis. Another approach would be to say, okay, you're looking at network traffic every day. You know, again, we're good statisticians, so let's just take the average. There's a lot of reason why you want to do that. In this case, and I think in the business that we're in, things change. In telecommunications, things change sometimes too fast for my liking. But I'm not sure that I want data that occurred several months ago to influence my graph today. So, you know, one bad thing about averaging and averaging through time is you want to make sure things are stationary in time if you want to be using this for sort of prediction purposes. So I think in many senses, this is, at least in our applications, this is too wide of a definition. And the common sense, I think, approach would lead to something like a moving average. Let's look at the traffic over the previous 30 days and, you know, use those data to capture what the dynamics are in this graph. Now, I wrote the word too many here, and this is where there's an interplay between statistics and computing. These graphs are big, they take up space, and you've got to manipulate them. In this definition, suppose, you know, we wanted G to be a moving month's worth of data, there would be 30 of these beasts, and we're going to compute this today, tomorrow, indefinitely into the future. So that means we have to keep all 30 of these around because tomorrow I'm going to get a new G, and then I got to subtract out the old G. So there's a lot of bookkeeping and a lot of storage and manipulation associated with that definition. What we finally ended up doing, and what we like a lot, is a definition where it sort of gets the benefits of computing a moving average without the sort of hassle of keeping all of these daily graphs on hand. So this is just an exponential moving average. We say that the graph today is a convex combination of the graph we had yesterday plus today's data. And theta is, you know, a parameter between 0 and 1 that describes how much aging, or, you know, how much the new data is going to be added in and how fast you're going to age out the old data. And the beauty of this is you basically only have to store one graph, you know, capital G, because every day all you're going to do is add new data to it, and that becomes your new graph. And then tomorrow you put this over here, and add a new thing in. So this blends, gives you the nice benefit of a moving average. You're capturing behavior that's recent without the extra cost of having to bookkeep on all these old small networks. So all I've done here is expand the recursion, and I may have a picture of that recursion in the next slide. It shows various values of theta that we use depending on the application. If we set theta equal to 0.4, basically what that does is if we took a one-hour call with a theta of 0.4, that is kind of pushed through this machinery in a week. So a one-hour call is a one-hour call on day one, but after a week, we basically discounted it completely. We tend not to push things through our data machinery that quick. We like using moving months. So theta equal 0.5 says that this one-hour call, by the time you go 30 days, it's fallen out of the graph if that particular edge does not receive another call after 30 days. Okay, so let me talk about the next step. So that's basically setting up our straw man. Well, it's not a straw man. That's our definition of what a dynamic graph means. We want to try now to estimate this moving target, this one-month window of network activity. And now we're going to try to build a data structure that captures that we can actually compute with. And we're going to try to do it in a constructive way. And so this is the construction. For every node in this big graph, we're going to maintain a list of edges that terminate at that node and a list of edges that originate at that node. And that in itself, if you put those two things together, you actually have now this set of inbound and outbound edges is a subgraph of this large graph. It basically says, here's a node, here's all of its out edges, here's all of its in edges. I'm going to keep those all together in this thing called SV. And G then, which is the big network graph, can be thought of as the union of all these little subgraphs. I mean, it's not so deep. I think the key thing here is that this is over all nodes. For every node in our network, we're going to do this. And once you focus on that, this is kind of a dumb idea in a certain sense then, because it's redundant. Because we're doing this for every node, so that means every edge is going to be stored twice. Because with every edge, there's an origin and a termination, so this edge is going to be in both lists. Well, that's, if we want to do this, that's a price we have to pay. So what are the advantages? Well, if you do maintain the data in this way, you can expand larger subgraphs very easy. And let me show you what I mean by that. If you do have this graph, so this is the set S of V that I talked about. This is a node, this is a center node, and we maintain the list for every node of edges going out and edges coming in. Since we do this for every node in the graph, for this one, we have its edges coming in and edges going out. So we can say, okay, give me that one, and let's take these incoming ones. We have the list for this one, so we can get all those. We have it for this one, et cetera. So we can easily traverse out from a node to have not only a diameter 1 subgraph, but a diameter 2 subgraph. And David always said, well, if you can do it for D equal 1 and 2, you can do it for 3. So you can essentially expand a subgraph around any node very simply by building this index structure and this doubly linked edge list. Now, we're not going to do that. You have to get back to the application to say why you wouldn't want to do that. So there are some good computational but good other reasons. For instance, there are nodes in the graph that are supernodes, and that once you hit a supernode, your subgraphs get pretty interesting, pretty uninteresting pretty quickly. So there may be a node in your network which is 1-800-CALL-COLLECT or CALL-ATT or whatever, that millions of people call every day. If that was a node in this graph, as soon as you hit that node, if you maintained all the edges, the exact graph, you would bring into this subgraph everyone else who also called that node. Now, you may or may not want to do that. In our applications, we typically don't want to do that. So what we're going to do is actually censor our graph. And this is a deliberate censoring. So we're going to approximate our subgraph in a certain way. We're not going to give up on the fact that we're going to have a subgraph for every node. So we're going to do something for every node. And what we're going to do is look at the edges going out of it and coming into it, but we're going to truncate those edges that are where the weights are too small. So we're going to keep a top K list. And in the applications I'll be talking about later, we're going to keep the top 9 edges going in and the top 9 edges going out. So now we can do the same old thing we did before. We can say for every node, we can have this list of top 9 edges going in, the top 9 edges going out. And instead of giving us the subgraph of V from the whole graph, it's an approximate subgraph because we're only going to have at most 9 edges in and at most 9 out. And then you can constructively approximate the whole graph by just taking the union here. Now, an interesting thing happens is that we now don't necessarily have this redundancy. Because just because I'm an unpopular guy, I may only have 3 edges. Okay, so when I call Wayne, my edge is, that edge between me and Wayne is in my edge set. Now, Wayne might be a popular guy, and he has dozens of people calling him. If he were a popular guy, Wayne would have lots of edges coming in, and my edge between me and Wayne may have fallen out of his edge set. So it's not necessarily in both. So while many edges will be appear in it twice, that's not necessarily the case due to the asymmetry. The other thing we do, though, to try to help out our censoring is we don't necessarily strictly truncate. We throw away the edges, but we save their weights into something called category other. So we're going to sort of keep the whole mass of the graph as defined by the sum of the weights over the graph. But we're going to throw away the edges. And I can show you a picture of what I mean by that. Oops. This is the only animation that I've ever done. So if it works, it'll be wonderful. If it doesn't, don't blame me. It's PowerPoint. So this is me. And this is my complete subgraph. So I haven't done any truncation here. And these are the weights associated with edges. Now, what we're going to do is a top 4 approximation. So we're going to say, what does what I just said translate to if I'm only going to keep the 4 edges with the biggest weights going out and the 4 edges with the biggest weights coming in? Well, you can see that I have 5 edges, I think, going out and 6 edges coming in. And these guys over here are going to be the losers. So if I think of a top 4 approximation, something's got to happen over here because I'm going to be sort of throwing these things out. So what we do, and maybe I can now get fancy so you can see that those 2 edges near the top there get coalesced into one node called other. Oops. And the bottom node just loses whatever identity it has and becomes other. But the other thing that's happened is we've now aggregated the weight associated with those 2 edges to this node, other, and it now has a weight of 6, where this one just has the weight of 3 because there was only one node aggregated. So the point is that we're going to maintain the identity of all of these edges here because they're in the top 4. Here, we're just going to throw away the identity of the edges, even how many there were, and just save the total mass associated with those edges. So this is an effect that we're inducing on the data. Okay, so I think this is the final step on what we do in terms of the approximation, then we'll get into the applications. I said this was a dynamic graph, so this thing's changing every day. And when we first started 15 minutes ago, I gave a definition of what I meant by dynamic graph. So we've now approximated that graph. How does this approximation fit in to following this thing through time? Well, it's actually quite simple, at least our way of doing it is. We say that our approximation to the graph at time t is going to be, and let me try to parse this inside first, we do the same convex combination, theta times our graph plus 1 minus theta times new edges, where this part here is our approximate graph from yesterday, and this part here is all the new data from today that's untruncated. And we take this convex combination, and then we do the top K procedure to it. And so you can do this, and this gives you each one of these. We can do this locally for each edge set. And so this definition then simply corresponds to doing this locally around every edge and taking the union of all these edges, all these sets. So this is an example of how this works. Let's see. So this list over here is actually the top, I think this is the top 9 list that we had yesterday. So this, I think theta we used here was like 0.85. So take 0.85 times these weights. And now these are the new calls for today. And there were only 4 calls. And I think this one appears in this list, this appears in this list, this appears in this list. This looks like a new number that's not in this list. So when we take 0.85 times these weights for all these labels and add 0.15 times these weights for all these labels, we have a new set of weights. We now sort them, and we take the top 9, and I think this node down here actually drops out of the top 9 list because this one comes in because it's going to have a weight here of 1.5, where this one had a weight of 0.2. When you multiply it by 0.85, it basically has the smallest weight. So this is just our way of sort of marching through the data every day, node by node, and updating this data structure. Okay. Oh, so I'm not at the examples yet. We're almost there. I guess there's a couple of things here. Many of you have worked with decision trees, and you know there's a fallacy with decision trees. People love them because they're so interpretable. You know, as opposed to linear models or log linear models or logistic models. And everyone knows that's a hoax. I mean, because trees are interpretable if they're small, but they're really uninterpretable if they're large. And the same thing with graphs. I mean, graphs are great. You get nice, pretty pictures when they're small, but they're really, really uninterpretable if they're big. And that's sort of the problem we deal with. But there's also other problems associated with network data. That sometimes says we want to make our graph bigger before we make it smaller. So in actually working with these graphs, we may actually have to try to do something to undo our approximation. We've induced some truncation into our data. When we analyze the data afterwards, we may try to do some things to undo it. So the analogy here is if you're dealing with sensor data, you probably are going to use a proportional hazards model that takes into account the fact that they're censoring versus ignoring the censoring. We don't have a proportional hazards model for graphs, but hopefully David, by the end of today, will give me one. The next thing we have to deal with is we have lots of data, but we actually don't have all of it. It'd be nice to think that AT&T, for instance, was still a monopoly, so we could see all the edges that there were. But we're not a monopoly, and there are very few monopolies left these days. So some of the data we see, we only see parts of it because there are other carriers out there, other providers, and they have physical networks, and data goes on their networks. I mean, the Internet's a great example. I mean, what does it mean? It's a network of networks. And if you're an ISP or you're some other provider, you see traffic over your part of the network, not over the big cloud. So you may be missing edges between entities because you don't see the entire picture. The final thing, I think, is sometimes you see traffic at a certain level of geographic or regional aggregation, but not below it. So AT&T, for instance, is a long-distance company. We're not a local company or not in many jurisdictions, so we'll only see long-distance traffic, not local traffic. So by that I mean, if there are two people in Toronto that both call the same person in Alberta, we may see edges from Alberta to Toronto and Alberta to this other Toronto number. We will never see an edge between the two Toronto numbers. And in some of the things we're looking at, we may want to infer edges between local numbers. It's just that our data is insufficient to give us that because our network doesn't go down to that level. So we actually have focused on two approaches to try to solve this. And the one we've went to first, and now we're exploring a little bit the probabilistic methods. So as I mentioned earlier, in the algorithmic approaches, we'll actually throw extra edges into our network, into our edge sets, to account for some of the data problems that we've induced. And then we'll try to prune edges out to get rid of the clutter. And I think this is an example of this algorithmic approach. So suppose this is the edge set that actually comes from my data structure, a D equal 2 subgraph centered on me. So again, there's these, you know, category other, and you know, this looks like a top 4 edge set. And what we're going to do is put a few more edges in. So I'll try to, you can see I'm adding a few edges. And this might correspond to the fact that maybe this node is local to me, so I'm just going to force an edge in there. And then what we typically do is then, once we've added in these edges, you can run an algorithm like strongly connected components, which is a way to get rid of edges in the graph. And there are many algorithms in graph theory that you can run. Strongly connected components, we just gravitated to it because, you know, we had available code. It basically says every node in the subgraph that results from applying strongly connected components, you can get from any node to any other node. And so this might be the graph we actually use in analysis. Again, the big graph has too much clutter, just like a big tree has too much clutter. We want to prune it back to something that more conveys the fact that this is kind of the community of interest or the calling circle of the node that we're studying. Rob? Well, that's one reason. Right. Ad hoc. Yeah. So again, you could put in a weight, sort of the minimal weight. I guess the weight we put in would be the minimal weight, I think, associated with the complete subgraph. And then the strongly connected components algorithm we use doesn't even look at weights anyway. It just looks at the edges unweighted. We could do an SSC with weights, but we haven't explored that. So I think Rob points out that, you know, this, it's ad hoc, but it's fast. And so there are some benefits, and you'll see those benefits when I tell you how big our data set is. This is certainly the more palatable approach, a more probabilistic one, where, you can actually, if you think of these now, the subgraphs, you know, it was kind of hopeless to think of this big, massive graph in a probabilistic sense and, you know, trying to be able to estimate probability distributions over this big thing. But you can actually think of it now in terms of these subgraphs. So, you know, each subgraph you can represent as an incidence matrix, you know, all the nodes along the rows and columns and weights or entries wherever you have an edge, a directed edge from this node to this node, and actually think about fitting, and other people have proposed fitting log-linear models to such data. And so these are local log-linear models, so that, for instance, if you parameterize this log-linear model in this way, I have this, again, the nice thing about statistical methods and parametric methods are there, you know, you get things that you can interpret. So there's some parameters here on the log-linear model, theta being the grand mean, alpha being a parameter associated with the out degree of a node, beta being a parameter that corresponds to the attractiveness or the in degree of a node, a global parameter rho, say, setting it equal to a constant, is a reciprocity. So it says, you know, it relates to the probability that if you have an edge from I to J, how likely is it that you have an edge back from J to I? And these are models that I think have probably a 20 to 30 year history in the field of social networks. And we're just starting to explore them now. And the way, I guess, we think of using this in the context of what I just described, this could be our incidence matrix for our observed data. So I think this may be my community of interest or my subgraph. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 nodes. And so, again, this is the same nodes down the rows as along the columns. and the squares denote the weight associated with edges going from this node to that node, or this node to that node. Now, if we just take the observed data and threshold the weights, we may get a picture that looks like this. That would be our subgraph. If we use this log linear model that I showed before, you can smear some of the mass associated with the weights to other nodes, because each node now has its attractiveness and expansiveness value, and that smears some probability around, and then you can think of thresholding that fitted model, and then this would give you a subgraph that you can work with. So that's kind of the goal of what we want to end up with. Observed data has some problems. We're going to either manipulate it algorithmically or statistically to come up with a subgraph that conveys in some sense the calling circle or the community of interest of each node in our graph. Okay, so that sets it up for the last, hopefully, 10 minutes to talk about the applications. And this gives you a sense of how big things could get. And so the data we're going to be talking about is from our long-distance network. This is how many edges we see a day. And the key thing here is a day. We see 300 to 400 million edges each and every day. And they keep coming. And you know, over time, if you look over a 3 month window, we see 400 million nodes, unique nodes in our network. So again, think of this graph. 400 million nodes and billions and billions of edges. So that's the nature of what we're working with. We use the top 9 approximation throughout. So for every node, all 400 million, we keep the top 9 in, the top 9 out, the weight associated with those, and every node has its own category other on in and out that characterizes that truncation that says if the top 9, if there are more calls than to the top 9, it overflows into that. Again, the computer science part that I won't go into, we have a nice index structure for this beast. You can compress it down to 7 gig map. It takes 2 hours each day to update this in each direction. And that's only on a single processor. I mean, it's not, and these are slow processes because it's on a big machine. It's probably like a 250 megahertz Sun processor from their old E10000 of 5 years ago. But this is done once a day, and it takes 2 hours for each direction. If we wanted to read all the data for each direction from these maps, it takes about 20 minutes to scan the whole thing. That's typically not what we do. What we do is do a lot of expansion. Again, there are 400 million nodes. We like to focus on the interesting ones, and we're always what's the right word? Fidgety. I mean, we want answers fast. If we want to find out what's going on at a node, we don't want to wait 20 minutes or 2 hours. So this is tuned so the data structure so that in a second we can expand the equal to subgraph, and by the time the data is shipped across the country and we enhance it and render the subgraph, what we're trying to do is engineer it for web time. You click on something and within a few seconds you have the picture of hopefully the picture of what you want. Well, that depends on the application. Right. And then we also have methods that look at, I'll describe those, that give the analyst some idea of what's an interesting node. Okay. I'm going to skip those. Okay, so in terms of the applications, both applications I'm going to talk about have to do with fraud. Fraud is great. I mean, we love it. Not from the point of view of the business, but it keeps statisticians employed. And it doesn't go away. It's wonderful. So there are people out there, I guess we'll call them customers, but they don't want to pay. And there's two ways they typically get service. One is something that's becoming far more known these days, something called identity theft, where through various channels people can assume your identity, and then they apply for service pretending they're you, and they're very good at it, and they carry it out. And so if someone presents himself as you, we look at your credit rating and it looks good, you'll get service. And then when you get a bill, because you'll come back to us and say, well, you know, why are you sending me this? And that's when we finally find out that someone has stolen your identity if you haven't found out before then. The other way is sometimes because we live in a competitive environment, we don't do all the credit checks that we should do, and so, you know, it's our own it's a problem of our own making. We let people in that we probably shouldn't let in. But the net of it is the customers, so-called customers we're leaving in, have no intent to pay, and we often don't really find that out for 3 months. So, you know, you sign up for service, in a month we'll send you a bill. In 2 months we find out we didn't get paid, and so we send, you know, you must have forgotten this. So another month goes by, and then, you know, that's when we'll start getting more aggressive. But so you basically had 3 months worth of service for free. So obviously, you know, you want to catch it as fast as possible. Now, so how does this all fit into this? Well, sort of the fact of life is these fraudsters seldom work in isolation. There's a lot of organized activity out there where people, you know, they have their own business and they sell compromised phone service to their customers. So there may actually be paying customers at the end of the line, they're just not paying us. The point is, though, that because they don't work in isolation, there's clustering in our network of fraudulent behavior. And what the goal of, you know, this whole talk was is to exploit this clustering in the network to help identify new instances of fraud. So this is a picture of one of these communities of interest. So this would be, say, a suspect. This would be their community of interest that we computed. I think this is an application in 800 subscription fraud. So the round nodes are the numbers associated with toll-free, and the rectangular nodes are normal toll lines. Any node that's fully colored in blue, they've already been discovered and taken down for fraud. And what we're trying to do here is to say, well, here's a suspect. This suspect is quite suspicious because there's 5 fraudulent cases in their immediate neighborhood. So that would be the intuition behind what we're going to try to do. So the process that we actually do is for, and this is kind of interesting, for each new account, what do we mean by that? Well, because fraud sort of occurs in real time and these processes are ongoing, we actually don't wait for someone to tell us we have a new customer. We basically see new activity in our network when it happens, and that's when we know we have a new customer. So in this case, what we do is after we see activity on a new number, we keep that number and the date and time when we see that activity, and then we wait 7 days. Okay. And at the end of that 7 days, we compute their subgraph. We enhance it and threshold it. And then what we do is sort of graph coloring. We then say, okay, you have this guy's community of interest. Now sprinkle on it all the fraud you've recently seen and how much of that fraud sort of ends up being sprinkled on this suspect's or on each new phone number's community of interest. And then you can rank those. So you can see this one had 5 that we just showed. Maybe there are some new accounts that had 10. Most of them have none. And then you can render that through a web application. So the idea then, you know, what Wayne was getting at, is every day we're looking at data that's aged for a week. We have all their communities of interest of all new accounts that have come up 7 days ago. We've computed their D equal 2. We've now colored that according to how much fraud there was in that COI. We've ranked those, and now we have a list that the fraud associates can start clicking down, and then they basically bring up these plots and do their investigations to identify. So we're giving them interesting nodes and the means to investigate them. This picture is trying to calibrate how good this is. So this is a relatively small sample. We gave them 105 cases that had a varying number of nodes in communities of interest that were labeled as fraud. So I think this is a one out here. So one new account had 16 baddies in his community of interest. There were 37 new accounts that had four baddies in their community of interest, 29 that had five, 13 that had six. And this is actually, I think, a logistic curve that I fit to the data that shows, I think, pretty clearly that the intuition is on target, that as fraud contaminates a person's calling community, that is, you know, this clustering effect, that the probability that the account is actually fraud increases. So after you get beyond a point of having six baddies in your community of interest, you're almost certainly fraudulent yourself. So that's exploiting not only, you know, the network data structure, but the fact that there's this clustering. The final thing, and I'll wrap up in within a few minutes, is somewhat more aggressive or ambitious. So we're actually going to try not only to identify fraud and turn it off, but try to link accounts through time. So the idea here is that fraudsters, because there's enough fraud in the network and it's hard to get law enforcement interested in it, all you do is shut them off. And fraud is wonderful in the following case as well. You don't have to be perfect. You just got to be better than your competitor. Because, you know, the fraudsters will, if you make it tedious enough for them, they'll go to MCI and do their fraud or Sprint. Wonderful. And then when they catch them, they come back. And, you know, and then, so part of this is when they come back, can you get them again? And so, you know, again, if you don't harass them too much, they're very loyal. They'll commit fraud forever. So your goal is to harass them, and again, they'll leave. So what happens is sometimes we'll see, you know, recidivists. You know, people commit fraud, and they come back. And, you know, it's embarrassing, you know, to the company and at least to us personally that they get away with this. So we're out to stop that. So even though their phone number when they come back may have changed, it may be the same individual behind the account. And again, if left undetected, you know, the same, you know, yada yada, you know, same story. But again, it's the same guy, and we just, or fraudster, we just, you know, it's embarrassing that they should get away with this. So our plan here is to say, while the identifier has changed, that is their phone number, you know, it's doubtful that all the phone numbers of all your friends, relatives, and enemies have changed. So let's exploit the fact that, you know, you pretty much who you are who you call, or you are who calls you. So we're going to exploit the network structure, but now we're going to bring in time. So the idea here is that we have some baddies. When we shut them off for fraud, we can capture their community of interest, and we'll put it in a library. And as we watch new accounts come on the network, we'll actually do a distance. We'll say, how close is this newbie to the baddies we have in our library? So again, we have a list of fraudsters. We save their edge sets. For every newbie, we wait a week, or in this picture, a month. And then we basically try to compute the overlap between each of these and each of these, so computing big distance matrices full of things. And then we'll actually rank the accounts according to a probabilistic model we built based on this. And again, I won't have too much time to go into the details. It's an open problem on what do you mean by how much are these two subgraphs the same. It's not enough to just count the number of nodes they have in common. Because again, Wayne might be a very popular guy. The fact that I call him and someone else calls him, that doesn't link me to this other person that much if he's a very popular guy. But if I call David and David's unpopular, the fact that I call David and someone else calls David, that's a much stronger link, we believe, that these two people who call David are linked than someone popular. So this formula is meant to discount overlap for the you know, the amount of traffic going into these nodes. This is just an example. So this is a likely case of the same fraudster showing up with a new number. I think this is a case of cellular. Let me describe what we have here. There are actually two phone numbers superimposed in this node, and we superimpose their subgraphs on top of each other, and any node that's pink is in common to both of those subgraphs, and any edge that's red is common to both of those subgraphs. And so this node here was only associated with one of the numbers, and I think this one is green. It was associated with the other number. These other nodes are pink. They were associated with both phone numbers. So you can see that these two numbers, when you overlay their subgraphs, they have a lot in common. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different phone numbers. So it turns out that this was the same individual. These self loops here are, again, this is cellular, and people call, at least with some wireless providers, you call yourself to pick up your messages. So that's what that business is. I think this square has a double boundary because when you take out a new cellular account, sometimes they ask you for a contact number. And so the fact that both of these numbers have something to do with this contact number is pretty damning. Anyway. I guess the final thing is based on actually building some models and then providing pairs of phone numbers to our security group and then looking at how well did we do. It's reasonably well correlated. So this is the deciles of predicted probability, and this is what actually happened for a test set. So, you know, if we say that these pairs shouldn't match or are unlikely to be matches, they seldom match. If we say they're likely to match, you know, they do, but, you know, if this was perfect, it would be a straight line. So it's not perfect, but, you know, it's at least monotone. Okay, so I'm done. You know, clearly, there's a lot of, you know, we've had a lot of fun and we'll continue to have fun. But, you know, at least as in my viewpoint in terms of statistics, there's a lot more opportunity here that we've, you know, has pretty much been untapped. Maybe I'll just leave for discussion what you think my future direction should be. But I appreciate the opportunity and thanks for being so attentive. Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.